Thank you very much. Can everyone, is this on correctly? Okay, great. Yeah, so I'm going to concentrate on maybe sort of talking about things that I've been thinking about since 2013. I've been thinking about them with Catherine Zurich, and then I'll also, hopefully if there's time, talk a little bit about some recent work that just came out with five collaborators, all at different institutions. It took a really long time to get that out. So I also want to acknowledge Vera Gluszczewik, Annika Peter, and Sam McDermott. Okay, so since this is also maybe partly a bit of a sort of get to know each other conference, I was going to mention, so as I said, I've only been sort of thinking about dark matter or working directly on dark matter since 2013. Before then, I sort of would work on cosmology or particle physics separately. So I've done beyond the standard model phenomenology, concentrating on sort of collider physics, and I've done inflationary physics, more cosmology. I've thought about ether theories, which Ted is an expert on back there. Anyway, it's one thing I'm love thinking about dark matter because it sort of marries the two, particle physics and cosmology, in a nice way. Okay, so I'm going to spend a little, I'll say a few things to introduce dark matter. The main thing that's interesting is we know it exists, very confident, but we don't really know what it is. So to remind ourselves, John actually already talked about this morning some, but doesn't hurt to mention again. So what do we know about dark matter? It's well named, it's dark, doesn't emit, absorb, or reflect light. It's matter, gravitationally attracts other stuff as if it were matter, actually as if it were cold, non-relativistic matter, at least today. It's not standard model matter. John took you through much of the reasoning there. And it also outnumbers normal matter in our local universe by about 5 to 1. By the way, these last two, the cosmic microwave background radiation, is really one of our best probes of these two facts. Okay, so what don't we know about dark matter? Again, John alluded to this. Well, we don't really know its identity. All of our evidence is basically has to do with its gravitational attraction. So if we step back and think about what is the identity of some fundamental particle, well, it's determined by things like mass and spin, and then also the other quantum charges or quantum numbers associated with fundamental forces. So here I've got the particle zoo version of standard model quarks and leptons. And got a chart of sort of relevant charges. And then there's dark matter. We know it doesn't fit up here. We'd like to know other things we know. We know that it doesn't have an electric charge, or at least we have a very strict limit on what it could be. Maybe it's millicharged, but we have good limits. And then it's not, it doesn't feel a strong force. Maybe it interacts weakly. That's a nice possibility that it's a weakly interacting massive particle. And maybe there's even some other forces it feels that we're just unaware of. So the goal is to continue filling out this chart. And as John said, another goal is for filling that out to sort of give us a better picture of the whole structure of the standard, the whole structure of particle physics. So I did this to remind myself that, you know, oftentimes, in fact, I'll mostly be talking about the possibility that there's just one species of dark matter. So I only need one more line here. Of course, there's nothing that says that there can't be other species of even sort of stable dark matter. And there's definitely nothing that tells us, well, there's something that tells us, but there could be a whole dark sector out there that we don't know about. So that's an exciting possibility. Okay, so how do we go about identifying what dark matter is? Well, as John said, there's reason to think that dark matter may interact with Standard Model particles, and there may be a possibility that dark matter and Standard Model matter can scatter off of each other, as indicated in this diagram. And by the way, if this diagram exists, I can just flip it around, so time is going left to right here. I can flip it around and imagine that dark matter could annihilate into Standard Model particles. I can flip it around again. Standard Model particles could annihilate and create dark matter. And another thing that can in fact be probed by actually astrophysical probes is dark matter interacting with itself. So this chart organizes, sort of tells you if dark matter couples, probably very weakly, but if it couples to these kinds of things, nuclear matter, leptons, bosons, or other dark particles, these are sort of the ways we expect to be able to probe those interactions. And figuring out all those interactions, is ultimately what we'd like to do. Okay, so today I'm going to talk mostly about direct detection, and that is probing scattering. I should say, please feel free to interrupt at any point. I've been sort of talking a lot. So are there any questions so far? Okay. Cool. Okay, so as I said, I'm sort of interested, or the theme of this talk is going to be sort of what can we tell about dark matter from direct detection. So this is a schematic of the currently most sensitive direct detection device. It's called LUX for Large Underground Xenon Dark Matter Detector. So it sits underground in a mine. It's heavily shielded. I presume you've probably all seen pictures sort of like this before. Yeah, okay. So,
what mine or what part?
Is this the Sudan mine?
No.
It's the, which one? It's the one that's, I never remember. It's in, anyway, it's in, what's that? Oh, maybe it's Sudbury. I always forget between. Anyway, no worries. Okay, so right, the basic idea is that you have a vat of stuff, in this case liquid xenon, and it's in some state so that if dark matter particle comes in and interacts with xenon, then you can tell, sets off some cascade of photons and electrons, and you capture those with your detection material above and below. In this experiment, you can measure more or less the energy that was transferred to xenon particle, though, of course, it's not a perfect measurement. Moving on here, so we're all on the same page. So here's a cartoon of what happens, the theorist cartoon. Dark matter comes in. Of course, our best estimates say that there's lots and lots of dark matter that should be streaming through our detector every second. And very occasionally, we get an interaction to occur. And ideally, we also can measure the energy of this guy that's coming out. Okay, so it's not a very sophisticated setup. Just have a bunch of stuff there, wait for interaction, and hopefully you can measure the energy and whether there was an event at all. Yeah, Aysen. Okay, so, right, so there's, I'm just showing you an example of the most powerful, or the sort of most sensitive detector right now. This is actually going to be a big point, is that, and in fact, you know, there's a lot of different direct detection technologies that use, for example, germanium, fluorine, lots of different sort of elements, and that's actually really important in determining we can use that fact, the sort of complementarity of different elements, to say a lot more about dark matter than you can with just one. So I'll get to that in a second, but along those lines, if you think about sort of what could the probability of that interaction sort of possibly depend on? Well, there's properties of the target nucleus itself. Those could include the spin and orbital angular momentum, or sort of average of those for the various nucleons that make up the nucleus. It could depend on the mass. It could depend on the particular proton and neutron content of the nucleus. It could also depend on properties of the dark matter, so its spin, its mass, and then if you just look at sort of what are the, in the simple elastic, by the way, I'm looking at elastic scattering, I should have said that, so we're conserving energy and momentum, you can also consider inelastic scattering, and that brings in all sorts of extra model dependence that I won't talk about. So anyway, kinematic quantities that probability can depend on are the velocity of the dark matter, which by the way we don't know, and then the nuclear recoil energy, which is in fact something we measure. Okay, but anyway, I want to draw your attention to the fact that just sort of in principle, this probability of interaction can depend on properties of the target nucleus. And so this is a sort of typical way that experiments will display their results in a direct detection experiment. On the horizontal axis is the mass of the particle. On the vertical is, just think of it as the interaction strength. And this plot has, oh, it's actually hard to see. This plot has, so the curves represent limits in the cross-section mass plane on possible dark matter interactions. And everything up to here at the time this plot was made are actual experiments. So the lines from here and sort of up and above are actual experiments that have been run. And this also includes a bunch of theoretical lines for experiments that are planned for the future. I'm showing you this plot, and by the way, these, does anyone know what these blobs, so in terms of the limit, everything up and to the right of these curves is disallowed. So strong cross, large cross sections and large masses are disallowed for each curve. The blobs, does anyone know what those correspond to? Yeah. Yeah, so the blobs are reputed detections. These are these so-called regions of interest. notice that many of them are not on top of each other. and with the exception of possibly, no, I would say fairly confidently, all of these blobs are very, several of them, the experiments now understand that they just misunderstood their background. And DAMA, for example, they've been claiming an 8-sigma signal for like 8 years or something like that. That's also real suspect for a lot of reasons, which I could go into more. Some of you probably heard the story. So the blobs, probably not real. but the thing I wanted to draw your attention to, so these different experiments, so for example, Cogent is a germanium-based detector. Xenon 100 is a xenon-based detector. COOP involves iodine and carbon. Picasso's not up there. So anyway, several of these experiments have different target materials. So how is it that I could put all these lines on the same plot? well, the answer is there's a lot of assumptions that go in to make this plot. I'm actually assuming something about how the interaction actually occurs. We'd like to actually be able to sort of tell something, right, about how the interaction occurs. What kinds of things does it depend on when we're in the process of identifying the theory of dark matter? The particular decisions that were made in terms of how the interaction occurs are well motivated theoretically, but they're not the only possibilities. And so if you're sort of worried about getting a detection in the first place, this is a totally reasonable thing to do to present your information. But recently people have been thinking about sort of being a little more agnostic when we're looking at our direct detection data in terms of what is it telling us. So that's sort of going to be the theme. So,
before you move on, can you tell me about the dashed orange line?
Oh, thank you. I'm glad you asked because I wanted to. That's why I chose this this plot. That was another thing I wanted to say. So this line, as you can see, it says neutrino coherence scattering. This is an basically in principle limit to the ultimate sensitivity of direct detection, period, because when you get down to these low cross sections and these kinds of masses, there's an irreducible background from neutrinos in your detector. So, as you can see, I guess that's the other thing, in the next not that many years, again, these curves are all sort of experiments that are planned. Not all of them are funded. LZ is basic. Lux has, by the way, already happened, but this is an old plot. So I mentioned that it's already, and this curve is actually close to what they actually found. The point is, the experiments are going to do a really good job of sort of probing almost all the parameter space they can sort of possibly probe, at least under the standard assumptions about how interactions occur. Okay. Maybe I should also mention, so some of these blobs, as you can probably see, are regions where some candidates would lie in this plane. Yeah, Alex.
Can they tell what direction the candidate particle is coming from when it bumps into the nucleus? Because I would assume that they could look at most of those neutrinos must be coming from the sun. Couldn't they just exclude things by direction?
Yeah, you just hit on a very popular idea for future versions of direct detection, which absolutely might change this curve. So directional direct detection is something that's, there are, I think, a few experiments. There have certainly been proposals. And yeah, using the direction, if you could tell the direction from which the dark matter particle came in from, it would be very beneficial because you could possibly eliminate some of that background. Because that's right, most of the neutrinos are going to be coming from the sun. So you could definitely, if you could get directional detection, that would be very beneficial. All of the curves up here so far, they were non-directional. So it's challenging to do directional direct detection. But there are concepts to do it, and that would be awesome.
What do they actually see if something slams into a nucleus? I mean, they just have a tank of stuff there. I don't actually know what happens. How do they get out? When I think of solids, I think of, okay, so they're producing a few phonons. How do they see that? So what's the...
Yeah, it's really, they have, so it depends on the material, and I'm certainly not an expert, but I know they collect, sometimes they apply a voltage and have sort of a drift chamber, and there's some electrons that get knocked loose, and they collect those, and then there's also photons, and they have photo multipliers at the end, so it's electrons and photons. For example, in the xenon case, in fact, COOP, for example, is actually basically a bubble chamber. So they have some kind of like superheated liquid, and it, and then they actually see bubbles. but basically it's some combination of charge and photons that you're collecting, and it's very much a sort of empirical game to find out the translation between how many photons you collect or whatever the spectrum, and then what was the recoil energy. And then I guess the other comment I could make on this slide is notice that there's sort of, once you get down to, maybe one comment is the most sensitive region in terms of the mass is right around 100 GeV. Well, that's basically because the nuclei are around 100 GeV, and you have the most efficient transfer of energy in an elastic collision when you have two particles whose masses match up very well. When you get up to higher masses, there's actually a degeneracy between the cross section and the mass, right? It's just a straight line. And that's basically because the mass dependence of the dark matter always comes in terms of the reduced mass of the dark matter nucleus system. And so once the dark matter mass gets a lot heavier than the nucleus mass, the reduced mass just looks like the nucleus mass, so you have no mass discrimination. And then another thing that might be of interest is all these curves sort of asymptote when you get down to the low mass range, and you can see neutrino scattering becomes stronger there, just because the energy deposited is going to be too small to detect. So those are sort of limits of direct detection. Okay, so I've circled several of the elements that are sort of most that are in various detector technologies that are either implemented or scheduled for the near future. As I said, one of the things I'm going to be talking about is sort of how we can use using different targets in your detectors is really important in terms of sort of going beyond just a detection and trying to actually figure out something in more detail about the interaction. Okay, and so to do that, I'm going to talk a little bit about the effective theory of dark matter direct detection. So far, I've sort of talked about motivation and basics of direct detection. Now I'm going to talk about this effective theory, and then if there's time at the end, I'll talk about some results in this recent paper. Okay, so in more detail, what is the scattering probability? At least if we're talking about non-directional direct detection, it takes the following form. And so it depends on some differential cross-section that you calculate given your particle physics. And another big thing that's a real ambiguity and a challenge in interpreting direct detection is that you don't actually know the velocity of your incoming dark matter particle. All you measure is the recoil energy. So when you're trying to get the rate, you have to assume something about the velocities. So what you do is just try to get a good estimate of the distribution of velocities of dark matter locally near the Earth. We have models of that. And and then you also need to know the local density of dark matter. Obviously, if there's more dark matter, you have a larger scattering rate. So there's this whole astrophysics part that comes into the rate, which introduces issues. There's also issues in this particle and nuclear physics part. So that's what I'm going to talk about. And by the way, so first of all, there's an escape velocity for dark matter locally. So there's basically an upper limit on the speed that the dark matter could possibly have. It's something around 550 kilometers per second. We think that on average, typical dark matter velocities relative to Earth are something like a couple hundred kilometers per second. And typical recoil energies are going to be much smaller than nucleon mass. So we're really working in a non-relativistic limit with direct detection. Okay. So if you're going to calculate this rate, and I guess if you're talking about sort of an ideal direct detection experiment, this rate, if you had lots and lots of statistics, is something that you basically can hope to measure. Right? You can get you can get the number of events and the distribution in terms of energy. So this is a thing that you hope to measure. You'd like to compare it to theory. The theory part, in principle, if you have, so I should say, this top, the top box here is what sort of the goal, what we'd really like to extract from our experiments. But since we're talking about non-relativistic physics, effectively the rate that you're really measuring is, I should say, the sub T here is for target nucleus cross-section for scattering off the nucleus. In terms of identifying the identity of dark matter, what we'd really like to know is something about scattering cross-sections off of quarks or something like that. But we can't know that. So in calculating this cross-section, you sort of have to take limits. First, you probably calculate, you have some fundamental theory. Then you use QCD to figure out what the actual rate would be for scattering off a nucleon. And then you use nuclear physics to figure out what the dark matter nucleus interaction rate would be. And I mean, what one could do is sort of start with some particular model and do these steps. Or if you want to be a little smarter about it, Weinberg taught us you should probably use an effective theory to organize sort of the possibilities for what this rate can be and how it maps onto the fundamental, I guess, high energy theory. So just to give you a feel for how that happens, I'm going to give you sort of an example of the kinds of assumptions that go into this standard plot that you see for direct detection. So suppose that your dark matter interacts with regular matter by there's a scattering that's mediated by, say, a scalar particle, which couples to the dark matter, and to quarks, or maybe it's also there's some vector mediator that couples to both standard model and quarks. If you go down to the dark matter nucleon level, you'd get an effective Lagrangian that looks something like this. an effective contact interaction. This is just parametrizing the strength of the interaction. Lambda is the scale that entered. In these cases, I guess it would be something like the mass of the mediating particles. And then to actually calculate the scattering rate off the target nucleus, you do some nuclear physics, and what pops out is the classic case of a spin-independent interaction. Interaction does not depend on the spin of the dark matter or the spin of the quarks or the nuclei. Does anyone have a guess as to what Z and A are here? The atomic number and the atomic mass number. So you get a sort of coherent scattering off all the nucleons in the nuclei. This ratio tells us that this cross-section also depends on the relative strength of coupling to the neutrons and protons, which ultimately depends on the... I did a squiggle because I left off coupling constants here. Anyway, so these are definitely model-dependent things. In that standard plot, usually people assume this ratio is 1. So isospin symmetric. And then this factor here is a nuclear physics factor. It's a form factor that characterizes the finite size of the nucleus, basically, or the fact that the nucleus is not just a point. Okay. Yes?
In your effective field prediction, you're assuming that dark matter is fermionic.
Yeah, in this example, I was assuming that the dark matter is fermionic.
If I heard you correctly, you said that was the bottom result was not dependent on that?
That's true. So if you had scalar particles, you'd get the same form, yeah, for most scenarios, yeah.
Just a question, the sigma p has no energy dependence, is that because you're not relativistic?
Yeah, so basically what I've done is, or what people standardly do is factor out the coupling strength of the proton, and this is something like the total rate for scattering off of a proton, and you just sort of factor it out. It's the thing we use to characterize the coupling strength, but it has units of a cross section. Yeah. Yeah.
Is there any reason from any sort of place to prefer spin 1/2 spin 0?
In terms of the short answer is no, not really. Yeah. Yeah, the short answer is no, not really. Other than you could, yeah. So, but yeah, as I said, and in fact, if you have a scalar dark matter, for example, it's hard to get something other than this. But for fermions, there's a lot of other possibilities, which is what I'm sort of going to talk about. Okay, so as I said, this is sort of the standard possibility that people think of. But recently, folks have been trying to be a little bit more systematic and think of, all the possible. They've been trying to be a little bit more systematic and a little more sort of agnostic about what's going on. So these folks, Fitzpatrick, Haxton, Katz, and Lubbers, wrote a really important paper in which they systematically went through and wrote down the relevant effective theories at the dark matter nucleon level and dark matter nucleus level in the relevant effective theory, which in particular is relevant in the, or holds in the non-relativistic limit. And they pointed out, just sort of stipulating, okay, I'm going to write down all the operators I can write down that are Galilean invariant and Hermitian and, to have the right properties. And turns out there's around 10 at this dark matter nucleon level. And then, especially because Haxton is a nuclear physicist, they did the very useful thing of mapping out how these non-relativistic operators get translated into the effective dark matter nucleus interaction. and did the nuclear physics. And it's useful to know that there's basically five independent types of so-called nuclear responses that could possibly be relevant. And these basically track, if you will, properties of the target that sort of could be relevant. Okay, just to give you a little idea of what those 10 operators look like, they organize the effective theory by writing down, okay, my interaction Lagrangian is going to have some contact form, and there's some operators sitting in here, and they're built out of the following quantities: the momentum transferred, the velocity. This is just a combination that is turns out perpendicular to the sky, so that's convenient. So v perp dot q zero, and then the spin of the dark matter, the spin of the nucleon. So turns out there's 10 ways of combining these things to get a scalar for your interaction Lagrangian that also obeys Galilean invariance, and such. These operators are Hermitian. So in this new language, spin-independent interaction, the relevant operator is just the identity operator, and that gives you the usual spin-independent response. And in that case, again, in the spin-independent case, the strength of the interaction depends on how many protons and neutrons you have in your nucleus. Another case that has gotten attention before recent years is, okay, let's just a spin-dependent interaction. They actually pointed out that you can sort of have two separate kinds of spin-dependent interactions, longitudinal or transverse. And then some sort of more interesting possibilities that have gotten less attention are if you have operators that involve this velocity, that can lead to sort of orbital angular momentum dependent responses. So your interaction can depend on, for example, what's the sort of orbital of your unpaired nucleon in your nucleus? So just to give you a feel for how much of a difference, you know, the different ways of the interaction, or sorry, the different properties of the targets that the interaction can depend on, how much difference that can make. I just pulled out a few plots in the low mass region from an older paper. And the thing to notice is that, so this plot is limits from this list of experiments or regions of interest in these cases. In the case where the interaction is spin independent, the standard case, or sort of standard spin dependent case. And the thing to notice is that the lines, like for example, this brown line, which corresponds to the Coupe limit, moves around a lot relative to the other limits. So it's just telling you that, and I guess the other thing that's obvious is the regions of interest, right? So this orange one is DAMA, cogent, and CDMS. If you have a different, if your interaction proceeds in a different way, you can actually get those regions of interest to line up a little better. So this has been, when you're interpreting a direct detection signal, you have to account for all the possibilities through which for that interaction.
There's a large number of orders of magnitude between the spin-independent and spin-dependent cross-sections. Those are on the same scale.
Yes, and it's basically because they're much more limiting for spin-independent because you get this factor of z in the cross-section. Accounts for a factor of 1,000 or something like that. And yeah, so it's partly that. Okay, and then you could also imagine, so these are two interactions you can sort of write down. Suppose actually that your interaction proceeds through a photon, or some other gauge boson. You can get, these are two interactions that have sort of orbital angular momentum dependence. And again, actually, this is kind of an interesting scenario. We got the regions of interest to actually overlap pretty well in this case. However, still ruled out by Lux, so not good. Okay. So I guess to repeat, it's smart to write down an effective theory when you're in the process of interpreting dark matter direct detection. We know sort of by writing down those effective theories, and we understand the mapping going from sort of your high energy fundamental theory down to the sort of effective theories, there's definitely a degeneracy between all kinds of different high energy theories and the effective theories. So we know that sort of direct detection isn't going to give you all the information you'd like, but we also know exactly the kind of information that it can give us. Okay, so in the last couple minutes here, let me talk a little bit about, let me try to answer this question somewhat concretely, thinking about actually the upcoming direct detection experiments So I'm going to tell you some about recent work that we just put out last month. Okay, so here's what we did. We simulated data for a variety of plausible underlying models that have, in principle, distinct phenomenology at this sort of direct detection level. And then we did model selection. So in terms of modeling the experiments, we included Poisson noise, though we also assumed perfect energy resolution, which is not realistic. Experiments definitely don't have perfect resolution. We realized the data, 50 realizations per model, per target, and then just used Bayesian statistics to do some model selection. Okay, so so we looked at, the names won't mean much. Just know that these are different sort of models that we thought were plausible that we sort of took. And the thing to know is they're all, we've got the standard spin independent, that's SI, and spin dependent. We've got a millicharge model that basically has a novel energy dependence in the rate, magnetic dipoles, electric dipoles, and anipole. And this is just showing you the spectrum, the dr by der, given the different models. So these two models, the green and the blue, they have the rate goes like E times something. So at zero, there's no rate. And this top one is for, again, assuming a dark matter mass of 50 GeV, scattering off xenon. For reference, this is scattering off fluorine or germanium. Obviously, things shift around a lot when you're scattering off fluorine, because fluorine actually has a large spin, very different structure than these other elements. It's also, of course, if you may remember, a lot lighter. Okay. And so actually, if you just sort of stare at the spectra, you can kind of already see which models could I possibly distinguish from other models in a direct detection. I should also say, the vertical, the units aren't quite right on the vertical axis here, but in simulations, we were setting the overall cross-section at current limits from, like, basically Lux from current direct detection. And the sort of the generation two experiments that we were modeling are based on sort of projections for upcoming generation two experiments. So let me explain. This is one of sort of a key result. So we have, like, as you can see, at least in one batch of simulations we did, there's 8 models here. Okay. So what we did, as I said, is simulate events on various targets that are, again, modeled on these generation 2 experiments that are upcoming. And then use Bayesian inference to determine the evidence for a given model given this simulated data. Each line here corresponds to, there's 50 lines, each one corresponds to a different realization of the data on a given kind of detector, so this is germanium. And the vertical axis, as you can see, is the probability assigned to the actual model that was used to simulate the data. So just, and again, as I said, we just had these 8 different models. They're given even priors. Excuse me. So germanium and xenon on their own don't do very well. It's only, the probability assigned to the correct model, again, is like below 0.4. Okay. If you combine germanium and xenon and recalculate the probability, which, again, it's basically just the evidence for the model divided by the sum of the evidences for all 8 models, right? Okay, that's the probability. But the thing to notice is that, so all the targets on their own, and even germanium and xenon together, don't do very well. By the way, I mean, these are the best funded, most common 2 experiments. So they don't do too well, even when we're just considering like 8 models. But if you add in another element such as iodine or fluorine, you get a huge improvement. So like adding in fluorine, 100% of the time you basically were assigning the correct model was given a high probability of being correct. Okay. So this is, as I said, the main result, like using several different targets, and in this case, just 3 different targets buys you a ton over just germanium and xenon, which is really where US money is being concentrated currently. Okay. Here's another example of a different underlying model. Same story holds. Germanium, xenon don't do too well on their own, a little better together. Way better if you add in an iodine or fluorine experiment. Okay, though another point, I suppose, is there are things that germanium and xenon can do. There is something that they do well. Namely, if you sort of separate your initial models, into classes according to the sort of really generic energy dependence of the rate. You can sort of see that the dark blue and the red sort of go in a category together. They actually, the purple and the red, and then these two. If you sort of look at, broadly speaking, models in terms of their energy dependence, then germanium and xenon can do well at putting models in the correct class according to energy dependence. But in terms of actually then selecting the correct model, they don't do well together. Okay, so sort of to conclude, to answer the question, how much of the theory of dark matter can be reconstructed from direct detection? At the beginning of the talk, I was trying to argue that, because direct detection is inherently a low energy thing, and what we're really interested in some sense is the high energy physics, There's certainly a degeneracy that's well understood between those two. And especially recently, in the last several years, it was just a matter of sitting down and being a little bit careful. But, in principle, we understand exactly what that degeneracy is. And then finally, including a diverse set of targets, and you don't even have to get that diverse, just get a little bit more diverse than just germanium and xenon. Including a diverse set of target can go a long way in terms of helping to distinguish what the low energy effective theory of dark matter nucleon scattering is. So finally, I guess I'd say this has sort of been a question that's been coming up in the workshop, is sort of, okay, suppose we get a detection. Like, what does that mean? Using just direct detection, we can tell something, but not a whole lot. And it's, in terms of really identifying what dark matter is, it's going to be a matter of using all possible avenues to explore the structure in order to get a good answer. And I'm sure it will take a while to construct a story that sort of works in every avenue: direct detection, indirect detection, collider physics, astrophysics. So, yeah, with that, I'll take more questions if you have them. Yeah, Don.
So I have a question. It's actually back to your first slide with the four possible modes of detection.
Uh-huh.
Is there any hope of indirectly detecting the presence of dark matter from finding, and this is not very tricky, but
sure.
something like the anomalous magnetic moment of the electron, which we know to ungodly precision.
Yeah.
And suddenly find a deviation there, I guess it would be evidence of something outside the standard model, but is there any work sort of trying to compare these dark matter models to what that might predict or not?
Yes. I mean, I guess, and if you have any given, as soon as you sort of write down a given dark matter interaction, if you're being really responsible, you should be checking limits. There's already a ton of places where you can sort of look for limits, including precision, basically any kind of a precision collider search, for example. I mean, certainly things like the anomalous magnetic moment. So there are certainly papers where people realize there would be a limit because dark matter could show up in some loop in that process. But there's not a systematic, effective, it's not super systematic, I guess is what I would say right now, in terms, it's scattered.
I don't know, you have to be in the ballpark that, should have went to another loop, you can detect it.
Yeah, but I think you're right though, as soon as you have anything that's a measurement to incredible precision, you're probably going to pay attention to that. Another big avenue that has gotten a lot of attention is like the invisible width of the Higgs. So a lot of these dark matter models, there is a coupling to the Higgs, and so that's going to be a huge thing as soon as the LHC. As soon as the LHC can pin down the width of the Higgs, that's going to be huge for a lot of dark matter models, for example. Yeah. Yeah, Alex?
Do you involve undergraduates in projects of this sort? I mean, the Monte Carlo simulations seem like a natural fit.
Yeah, so the answer is not yet, but I'm just now starting. So I have a couple students this summer, and yeah, I'm going to be... On this project I was talking about is actually a lot of the coding, most of the coding was done by Vera Gluszczewicz, who's a postdoc, but I'm currently training my students to sort of help me with some of the simulation and data analysis aspects of this work. Yeah. But we'll see if it works. Yeah. Herb.
Okay, I don't know what an anipole is, so
sure.
Explain that. But second, do any of these energy curves say anything at all about the spin of the particle that you're...
So I guess one useful thing that's sort of come out of this effective theory business is that you can only get certain kinds of nuclear responses and energy or momentum dependence. So it depends on the spin of the particle. So for example, to get orbital angular momentum response, if you just sort of write down all the possibilities for scalar dark matter, non-relativistic limit versus fermionic dark matter, you only get it in the fermionic case. So you could certainly tell something through that process, through direct detection, but not directly.
You didn't show any angular distribution.
Right, yeah. So, and...
That's what would have...
And I actually don't know if... I mean, again, in these experiments, we have no directional information so far. So, yeah, there's no hope for angular distribution. I don't... With directional detection, I suppose you'd have some kind of a possibility for that. But, yeah.
And what does anapole mean?
It's just a... Let me go back to... It's... Where's my operator? Here it is. Yeah, so an anapole moment is just... it's not a dipole moment, and it's not a magnetic dipole moment, it's not an electric dipole moment. It's a moment in the sense of you can have a coupling to the electromagnetic field strength of this form with this extra, so it's like this axial vector interaction. And actually turns out if you have Majorana dark matter, so matter that is its own antiparticle, and you want to couple it to a vector, you have to do it through this operator. So that's one reason that the anapole is kind of an interesting possibility. Yeah?
If there are dark matter particles that have these electromagnetic interactions, why don't they scatter enough light to produce a haze or something?
Yeah, so you certainly have to check. There are strong limits from those considerations, absolutely. Yeah, so it needs to be real weak. Just like, I mean, millicharged dark matter is another thing that hasn't been completely ruled out. But so yeah, imagine the dark matter has a tiny fraction of a charge, effectively. That's not been complete, you know, we have some limit. So that was the other. Yeah, Ted.
Do you have any comments I saw on the possible evidence for dark matter self-interaction that was reported recently?
In the sun or the...
galaxy cluster.
Oh, the more sort of generic. Yeah, I'm really interested in that. yeah, there's all these sort of astrophysics anomalies that people are trying to explain with dark matter. And I have just this summer kind of starting to been sort of looking into it a little more. It seems like there's promising possibilities, but then again, it's I don't know. It's messy because it's astrophysics and involves understanding these complex systems well. But yeah, I mean, there's like this core cusp problem that I'm sort of interested in. The simulations aren't of whatever it is, spheroidal dwarf galaxies, the density profiles, the simulations are not matching up with actual measurements of density profiles of dark matter. And people have suggested that self-interactions of dark matter could, so when this default model is to assume that dark matter has no self-interactions, and though in those simulations, they're not getting these density profiles right. So that seems like a really interesting possibility. And there's also like recently been this, apparently there's, we haven't, simulations predict that there should be order 10 pulsars within the first 0.1 parsecs in the center of the galaxy, and like we've only seen one. And one suggestion for the missing pulsar problem is that dark matter has self-interactions and actually sort of causes those pulsars to collapse into black holes. There's a lot of those. Of course, there's the gamma ray excess. There's lots of these sort of astrophysics anomalies that people have suggested dark matter, and specifically the self-interactions might help to explain. So, I don't know. I think it's interesting, but I don't I don't know. That's what I can say. And worth investigating.
More questions?
All right.